This is the Entrepology Podcast, the podcast where we optimize the bodies, brains, and lifestyles of entrepreneurs, go-getters, and world-changing innovators.
Welcome to the Entrepology Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Megan Walker. As an anthropologist and naturopathic doctor, I work with entrepreneurs and go-getters to optimize the health and performance of these world-changing innovators. Know anyone like that? Before we jump into today's podcast, I want to thank our sponsor, Legacy. Legacy is an online membership community that provides monthly accountability coaching with a personal health coach and access to lifestyle products at discounts not available to the general public. The neuroscience that connects the benefits of being accountable to another human being and our capacity to stick to goals and commitments is profound. We are sculpted by our commitment and discipline to our daily decisions. Legacy helps that happen. Legacy memberships start at just $22 per month. To learn more, visit legacymemberships.com. Today, I sat down with Dr. Dennis Wilson. Dr. Wilson is an integrative practitioner practicing in Florida, as well as an entrepreneur with an absolute passion and interest in understanding the tempo and the temperature of life. He doesn't just have a passing interest in thyroid health. He has an entire syndrome named after him. He is kind, witty, and speaking on a topic that affects so many of us, adrenal and thyroid health. The thyroid gland, Dr. Wilson explains, sets the pace of life. You won't want to miss this. I suspect you are moving kind of fast. So Dr. Wilson, you are so well known in this industry and your expertise with respect to thyroid and adrenals and keeping people going, as it were, which is what I always describe the thyroid gland as doing. It is such a pleasure to have you here today. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Megan. It's a pleasure.
Now, I want to right off the bat understand what motivated you from a philosophical perspective. You're a medical doctor by background, and you've pursued a journey that I'll say is notably less myopic, perhaps, than other thyroid or experts or endocrinologists who maybe followed a similar educational path as you. What influenced this interest, specifically related to thyroid and adrenal health, but also this perspective, this holistic perspective in terms of treatment?
Well, it all started many years ago, 25 years ago, I guess. And a patient came into my office and she brought with her a book called Hypothyroidism, The Unsuspected Illness, written by a Dr. Broda Barnes. And the premise of that book was that the blood tests aren't the best indicator of thyroid hormone function, and that you can also get a lot of information from the body temperature. His philosophy was that, you know, you diagnose the problem with body temperature and you might have to treat the patient for life using a T4 containing medicine such as Synthroid or Armour. But I was intrigued by it, and the patient was frustrated because she had gone from doctor to doctor looking for some solution, and that she always came back with a normal blood test, but she had terrible symptoms of hypothyroidism. So I agreed to look at the book. I found it intriguing. I gave it a shot. We gave her some thyroid hormone medicine. And to my surprise, not only did she get a little bit better, but she got completely better. And she wasn't the only one. I treated a number of people with this kind of philosophy or approach. And I saw that a lot of times people were getting completely better, even though their blood tests were normal. And that totally opened my eyes to, like you say, the philosophy or mindset, because it was at that moment that I realized, oh my goodness, if this was against what I had been taught in medical school. I was taught in medical school that you can tell for sure what someone's thyroid hormone function is like based on their blood test, and this was perfect evidence proving that that wasn't the case. And I thought to myself, oh my goodness, if this isn't true, then perhaps nothing I learned in medical school is true.
The classic crisis.
Yeah.
And so, you know, as you're saying this, I know there's people out there going, oh, well then, do I have a thyroid issue? Like all these years, my doctor's told me my thyroid is fine, and yet I have all these symptoms as if it's not. How do people start to know whether it's their thyroid and they could fall into this this population where things aren't showing up on blood work?
Well, it's really interesting. Like somebody could ask me, hey, Dr. Wilson, why doesn't this show up on blood tests? And then I could also ask them, well, why would we think it, why would we ever think that it would show up on a blood test? Because the thyroid hormone, the way it works is it goes into the nuclear, it goes into the nucleus of the cells and tells the body how fast to transcribe DNA. And DNA is the code of life. And so basically thyroid hormone tells our bodies how fast to live. And that happens inside the cells, inside the nucleus. And so there's no way that that would ever show up on a blood test. And I'm not sure why we would think it ever would. But the key to it is, though, the faster we live, the higher our temperature is. And the lower, the slower we live, the slower our the lower our temperature. So a thermometer is literally a speedometer. And when we go look outside and we see it's cold outside, what that means is that the air molecules are actually moving slower. And when we boil water, it speeds up until it is, it reaches escape velocity and turns into steam. And so when you put a thermometer in your mouth, you're actually measuring your metabolism. And not it's not a good measure of the metabolic rate. It's an exact measure of the metabolic rate because that's what it is. We're measuring how fast our bodies are living. And so that's actually the best indicator of the metabolic rate, or in other words, thyroid function, is what your body temperature is running. And the blood test just helps us narrow down the source of the problem, if there is one.
And will the temperature be off first?
There's two ways you can have a low body temperature. One way is if you have a low thyroid hormone supply, and the other way is if you have poor conversion. So I would say that yeah, you're going to have a supply problem or a conversion problem before you have a temperature problem. I think that's true, but the only way you know whether you actually have a problem is whether your temperature's high or low. So it's the first thing to check, but it's not the first thing to happen.
And where should people's temperature be?
37 degrees Celsius is ideal, or I say ideal. I shouldn't say that. I should say, you know, the body regulates its temperature for its own purposes. Sometimes it slows down during periods of stress and fasting to conserve energy, and sometimes it speeds up to deal with a fever, and so it changes according to its needs. However, a baseline temperature of 37 degrees is where most people feel their symptoms going away. For example, if I had a person come in with a temperature of 36.1, that would be enough to explain symptoms of fatigue, depression, dry skin, dry hair, fluid retention, even panic attacks and migraines. And the first thing I would try to do is try to help that person get their temperature to 37 degrees, because that's the temperature at which their symptoms are most likely to disappear.
And how do you reconcile that conversation that happens between those traditional care providers who will say, well, you know, TSH is normal, your thyroid is normal?
I would hearken back to the purpose of the thyroid hormone. And I think the reason doctors got so fixated on thyroid hormone blood tests originally is that if somebody had their thyroid gland removed, their TSH would go way up and they would go into some kind of coma. And that is something that you can see on a blood test. And so I remember Bob Utiker is the guy who invented the TSH test. And he once famously said, oh my goodness, I sure hope that doctors don't put too much stock into this test and forget how to treat patients. But he was worried that that doctors would look at the TSH test instead of looking at the patient, or in other words, looking at their temperature and symptoms. He was afraid that they would rule people out or try to make too many decisions just based on the TSH test when he never intended it for that purpose.
Right, and health can never fully be encapsulated from one marker on a blood test anyway. Yes. And I think most integrative clinicians understand that. You know, I think this is a really interesting conversation. I think for a lot of people, they're kind of going to go, oh, temperature. Like, I have a new metric through which I can and try to measure things that I'm feeling. You know, I get a sense in talking to people, both clinically and otherwise, that, you know, thyroid is pervasive. I put this in quotations, but, you know, everyone's got a thyroid issue or spoken to someone whose thyroid is not functioning optimally. What do you feel is behind this epidemic?
I think that toxins play a big role. I think that a lot of people are being exposed to toxins in our environment. Even animals, they're showing, animals in the wild, a lot of them are getting obese or heavier than they were before. And I also think it has to do with our stressful lifestyle. I think it has to do with, of course, our lifestyle and our eating patterns, our eating habits, and of course the nutrition and how much exercise people are doing or not doing. So I think it's a lot, but I think stress has a lot to do with it. Low sleep, you know, too much screen time, toxins. It's quite a lot of things.
Have you looked at all using blue blocking glasses and the influence that independently has on thyroid function?
No, I haven't. I haven't looked into that.
See, this is where I go off script, and I thought I would just throw that out there on you. It's just something I've been using more and more with my patients. I might play around with it a little bit and see what influence that has on temperature and get back to you. But blue light is something that's just so pervasive. And in particular with this population, it's not uncommon for people to be on their computer till 2 o'clock in the morning and then be disappointed that they can't fall asleep. So it'd be interesting to see the influence.
Yeah, that I'd be very interested in. And I think you've got a, like you said, great parameter there with the temperature. It'd be very interesting to see what difference that made.
Yeah, absolutely. In your experience, are there things that come up for people before their thyroid becomes a problem? So, you know, for me, what I'm thinking of in that, and I don't want to keep you guessing on my side because you might have more insight, is, you know, I tend to see people where there's a chronic history of adrenal fatigue or symptoms of adrenal fatigue, and then it segues towards thyroid. Is that observation corroborated in terms of your experience and your clinical access to far more people in terms of thyroid conditions?
Sure, absolutely. There's definitely people that you can treat for adrenal function and their body temperatures will come up and their quote-unquote thyroid symptoms will disappear. By the same token, there's sometimes where you will get somebody's temperature up to normal and their adrenal fatigue disappears because a lot of times the adrenals try to make up for the difficulty that the thyroid gland is facing and vice versa. They're like, I look at them as two members of a volleyball team or something like that. And they, so when one suffers, the other suffers. So that's why we almost always treat thyroid and adrenal problems together at the same time.
Right. And can you explain from your perspective what adrenal fatigue is?
When a person goes through stress, their body detects that stress and goes into what it calls alarm phase, and your body reacts to that with a fight or flight response. Cortisol and adrenaline and norepinephrine and hormones that help it deal with a very significant stress and like a predator coming after you or having to fight in a war or something like that. So then it gets your body geared up to be able to handle a situation like that. And the stress is supposed to come. You're supposed to get through the stress and then the stress is supposed to go away. But sometimes in our lives, in our world, maybe we get those hormones, but we don't do any fighting. Or we don't do any running. We just sit there and stew in these stress hormones. And the stress seems almost unrelenting because, you know, it's the next phone call. It's the next email. It's the next comment, you know, somebody makes. And it just, you know, more work, less pay, and just stress, stress, stress all the time. And so then you go in from a, it's kind of like, you can get resistant to the signal. In other words, if you hear somebody, like, it's like, I just can't, probably not the best example, but I think of bad parenting when your mother says, you know, if you don't stop that, I'm going to, you know, you're going to get it, you know, you're going to get punished, but the punishment never comes. And so the kid, the child might just tune out these empty threats and they don't even register anymore. And so it's kind of like that, I think, with the fight or flight response. You get adrenal resistance and you make more and more hormones trying to get your body to take some kind of action. And you just get into more and more hormones and you still don't take any action. And then eventually your adrenal system, with all this unrelenting stress and also this resistance, finally begins to wear out and you make less hormones. At first you're making too much and now you're not making as many. And now you're getting what we call adrenally exhausted or adrenally fatigued. And then you get into a situation where you have, you know, harder and harder time dealing with life and stress.
And so does everyone who has stress get adrenal fatigue?
I would say not. I would say not everyone that has stress gets into adrenal fatigue. If the stress occurs and they handle it proactively and consciously and responsibly and in a balanced way, and they have a balanced lifestyle, and in the sense that, you know, they work and they play and they're awake and they sleep and they eat and they stop eating and so on. If they have a balanced lifestyle and they get some downtime and go to Jamaica like my good friend Megan did recently.
That's a secret.
Oh, sorry about that.
No, I'm just teasing.
So, you know, that's what you want to do. I mean, so no, you're not automatically going to go there. If you, you know, live a balanced, healthy lifestyle.
Right. And so what do you do specifically to protect yourself from that? I mean, you travel, you're all over the place. Like, do you have an arsenal of little things that you do, or it really is living out that balance piece?
I would say it's living out that balance piece. But there's some things that I like to do. You know, definitely, I like to ride. I mean, for me, I ride my bike a couple times a day, usually with my wife. And we, so you want to, you know, eat right, and you want to have some time where you work and maybe sequester some time and, you know, plan your day a day ahead, like, you know, plan tomorrow before tomorrow comes, and then, you know, work your plan, but have some balance in there. And so, you know, so those things are part of it. I've been really intrigued lately with this concept of avoiding overfeeding. And what I mean by that is having a time where you eat, but also have a time where you don't eat. So it's kind of like an intermittent fasting kind of concept. But I think that's revitalizing to the body to have some time where you're not eating all the time.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I find, you know, if people aren't prepared, like if people aren't already healthy, that's a hard thing on their system.
Yes.
But I'll say for my advanced people, taking time and fasting in whatever context or format we come up with actually has some really profound outcomes for them. What kind of symptoms do you see with people who are adrenally fatigued?
Just very tired. Sometimes they have trouble sweating. They don't sweat. They don't handle stress very well. And so that's the main one I see is just if I get a story where someone explains how much stress they're under and just how they feel like they're at the end of their rope and they're just very chronically fatigued, then I start thinking about adrenal fatigue, especially if they've got a story of stress that's been for many months and or years and it just sounds like they're really worn out. Of course, I will have them take the temperature because I'll be thinking about, you know, slow metabolism as well, but I'll be thinking in terms of thyroid and adrenal. And of course, the low temperature symptoms are going to be fatigue, depression, dry skin, dry hair, might be premenstrual syndrome, migraines, panic attacks, anxiety, difficulty concentrating, could be itchiness, low sex drive, decreased ambition, decreased being in conversation or being a hard time coming up with the words and things like that.
Right. Fair enough. And as you're describing this, I'm saying in my head, welcome to the life of entrepreneurs, right? It's chronic, it's long-term stress, it's unrelenting, it's relationship stress, it's financial stress, it's performance, it's all of those different pieces. So it's naturally something that we tend to see a lot of in this particular population. Are there functional tests that you run on to look at adrenal fatigue? Beyond temperature?
Well, you could. I tend not to. In our experience, we like the treatment is the test, and we normally use a therapeutic trial with what I call potent groceries, which is the right kind of herbs and nutrients, and try to see how people respond to that. And I call them groceries because they're good for you, whether or not you have laboratory values for adrenal fatigue or not. But anyway, you know, some doctors do like salivary cortisol, or they like four times a day. And there are a lot of great companies out there. Dutch does a nice test parameters for cortisol levels, and there's other, you know, there's blood tests and things, but more, you know, we tend to be more clinical in our assessment and management, and just see how people do.
Right. And I talk about that with people all the time, that we're going to put things into play and actually just see how the body responds to it. And it gives you a sense of, are you in the right direction or are you not? You know, in terms of a conventional approaches to thyroid, if someone has an underactive thyroid, hypothyroidism, they're coming in on something like Synthroid. Is this the gold standard? I'm sure it's not for you, but what is your first line therapy for someone with hypothyroidism?
Well, if a person comes in and there's hypothyroidism and then there's low body temperature, and sometimes the way people use the word hypothyroidism, it's not totally clear what they mean. But when I have a person come in with symptoms and low temperature, and I think they might be thyroid related, the first thing I'm going to ask myself is, most doctors in a situation like that will only look at one parameter, like we discussed. They'll just look at the TSH test and they'll base everything on that. And the only thing I'm recommending that people do is, instead of just looking at that one parameter, we're actually going to look at two parameters. One is going to be the TSH test, and the other is going to be the body temperature. And with those two, you can assess not only the supply, but also the conversion, and you can help almost anybody recover. So at that point, if a person came in and they had a thyroid hormone supply problem, I don't like to give T4 containing medicine like Synthroid or Armour until somebody's temperature is normal. So I wouldn't give them T4 until I knew their temperature was normal. So if they had low temperature, Synthroid or IRFA would not be my first choice. I wouldn't go there. But if I, and so what I would go there is, if they did have a supply problem, I would give them T3 therapy. And if they had a normal TSH, then I would give them herbs and nutrients first. And if that didn't work, then I would give them T3 therapy. To the purpose of the T3 therapy would be to lower their T4 and reverse T3, which would hopefully upregulate their deiodinase enzyme, which I know that probably doesn't make a lot of sense to your audience, but it just kind of refresh the thyroid hormone pathways and get the conversion rebooted so they could start having a normal temperature on their own again.
So it sounds like something like Synthroid is much further down that list of interventions for you and considerations.
Oh, definitely. And the only time I would use it is like after their temperature was normalized, after they were rehabilitated or reset or rebooted and after they were restored to health. And they had a thyroidectomy, they had no thyroid function at all, or obviously needed something, then I would consider T4 as a supply for thyroid hormone, but only after they were back on their feet.
And what if someone has been on Synthroid for a period of time? Can they come off of it?
Oh, yeah. They can definitely come off of it. A lot of people that have been on Synthroid a long time, the first question I would ask them is, what was your TSH before you started thyroid medicine? And a lot of times those people, their TSH is going to be less than 4 when they started. In other words, their TSH was within normal limits when they started. And in a case like that, 100% of those people could come off of Synthroid because they didn't really need to be on it to begin with. But even if a person had a high TSH, even if it was 8, 10, or 15 years ago, it doesn't mean it's that low. It doesn't mean that their TSH would be that high now if they came off. So I've had patients who were on thyroid medicine for 20 years, and they had bona fide hypothyroidism in the beginning. But after T3 therapy and herbs and nutrition, we were able to wean them off the T3 and the Synthroid, and they weren't on any thyroid medicine at all, and they were able to maintain normal temperatures on their own. So, yeah, they can either – and even if a person did have a thyroidectomy and was on Synthroid and did need some kind of thyroid hormone replacement for life, that they still don't absolutely necessarily have to be on Synthroid. They could be on desiccated, or for that matter, they could just be on straight T3.
Right. And the caveat to all of that is that they're working with someone who can help inform that transition for them. The cold turkey, I'm going to come off Synthroid because I heard it on a podcast, does not apply here.
Yes.
Yeah, right? Like looking at all of those lifestyle pieces. And then, you know, the other realm in terms of thyroid conditions are those people who are having autoimmune reactions to their thyroids. And I'm thinking about the Hashimoto's and the Graves population. If we step back and we start to look at those populations, is from your perspective, is this they had a genetic susceptibility and it just got triggered? Or do you see other commonalities in terms of those individuals who have a propensity towards an autoimmune condition in their thyroid?
Well, I don't know that I can prove it or that anybody can necessarily, but there is a suggestion. It does appear that a lot of autoimmunity is coming from toxins, from environmental toxins or dietary toxins, if you will. And there are some people that do have leaky gut, or they do have gut problems, or they do have gluten sensitivity. And when they stop gluten, their Hashimoto's improves, or if they don't, their Hashimoto's gets worse. So there's a lot of autoimmunity due to toxins. And it's funny too, because autoimmunity can lead to low temperatures, but low temperatures can lead to autoimmune problems as well. So it can be like a vicious cycle.
So what is the mechanism that low temperatures lead to autoimmune conditions? Because that's so interesting to me.
Yeah. Well, every enzyme in the body has to do with body temperature. And so enzymes are what catalyze chemical reactions in the body. And a lot of times, like a chemical reaction in a laboratory might have to happen under certain conditions of temperature and pressure. And those temperatures and pressure are way higher than what you would find in the body, but these reactions can occur inside the body because of enzymes. And enzymes make these reactions go forward at lower temperatures and at lower pressures, and it does that by way of the enzyme's shape or conformation, and that shape is dependent on its temperature. So if an enzyme is too hot, it's too loose, and if it's too cold, it's too tight. But if it's just the right temperature, then it's just the right functionality. And so when, you know, and everything that happens in the body is mediated by enzymes. And so when your temperature, and that includes immunity and inflammation, and T3 therapy, for example, will decreases inflammation markers. T3 will lower inflammation. And of course, autoimmunity and inflammation are basically the same thing. Like when you say I'm autoimmune, basically you're saying my inflammation is out of control, or I have unhealthy inflammation or inflammation that's overreacting. And so T3 therapy will lower inflammation. It'll lower inflammatory markers, lowers insulin resistance, lowers obesity, lowers oxidative stress. And oxidative stress is important in autoimmunity. So, yeah, all these things can turn autoimmunity around.
And, you know, we've been talking a lot about temperature, and you are an expert on an entire syndrome related to temperature, Wilson's temperature syndrome. Can you describe what that is, and how you stumbled upon the temperature piece?
Sure thing. It's basically what we've been talking about, in the sense that people can have a normal body temperature. I mean, they can have normal thyroid blood test and still have a low body temperature, and they can still have all the symptoms of hypothyroidism. In fact, sometimes people can actually have hyperthyroidism. Their thyroid gland can be overreacting. They have oversupply of thyroid hormone, but their body temperatures are still low, and they still have symptoms of hypothyroidism. And so they have like what I call a peripheral conversion or utilization problem, where it's not a problem with thyroid hormone supply, but it's a problem with how much of that hormone is getting converted from T4 to T3. But the thing that was really unexpected in treating this problem is that I found that when I started treating these people with desiccated thyroid, 60% of the time they got better, and 40% of the time they didn't. But when I weaned the people off the T4 containing medicine, their symptoms would come back. And so I started thinking about that, and I started experimenting with using T3 instead of T4. And then instead of 60% of the time people getting better, it was more like 80 or 90% of the time. And the thing that was very unexpected is that when I weaned the people off the T3, a lot of times their symptoms and temperatures remained improved even after I weaned them off the T3. And so what I'm saying is, so one thing about this Wilson syndrome is that it's a reversible problem. And most of the time, I mean, historically, when anybody talked about thyroid hormone problems, they would say, oh, you have hypothyroidism, you're going to need to take thyroid medicine for life. And so this is an instance where somebody could have a very severe low temperature and thyroid type problems, but it's not something that necessarily happens for life. In fact, a lot of times you can get it completely turned around in 2 or 3 months. So it's a reversible low thyroid hormone problem or low body temperature problem that can be reversed with herbs and T3 therapy.
And do you test temperature on every patient you see?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's something that I always recommend. It's the first thing to check. In fact, you know, when you go to the doctor, when we're trained in medical school, we're trained to look at vital signs. When you're trained to examine somebody, there's 4 vital signs, and those are heart rate, respiratory rate,
metabolic rate, or I'm going to call it body temperature, which is like the metabolic rate, and then blood pressure. So it's one of the four vital signs. So of course, it's something, you know, and three out of the four vital signs have to do with speed or rate. And so I always tell people it's the first thing you consider, not the last, for a couple of reasons. One is that it can explain a lot of symptoms. It's like a very foundational piece that could explain a lot of difficulties. Two, it's extremely common that people have low temperatures. Three, it's imminently treatable. Four, if you better hope it's your temperature, because if it is, it's reversible and you can be cured. And then if you ignore that piece, you know, and you walk around with a low temperature, then it's going to be hard for you to feel good no matter what you do, no matter what you eat, no matter what medicines you take, no matter what drugs, no matter what surgeries. I mean, if you don't get it fixed and that's your problem, then you're going to have a very frustrating time with it.
Right. And what's so interesting about it is, to me, this is something that speaks to quality of life for people, right? You can function, you can get up, you can mask the problem, but I'm always wanting to take people from a place of where they're fine, right? Which is what the traditional experience with the medical system is, they just want to be told they're fine, to let's get you to a place of optimal health. And what a great marker to look at in terms of optimal health and sense of self and health on a daily basis. How do people take their temperature in terms of being able to get accurate measurements? And can I use just any old thermometer, an ear thermometer? Does it have to be in your mouth? What are the specifics?
The way you take the temperature, I recommend that people take it every 3 hours, starting 3 hours after they wake up, and to take it three times a day. So if they woke up at 7 o'clock, for example, they would take it at 10 o'clock, 1 o'clock, and 4 o'clock. It doesn't have to be exact, but about those times. And then they would take it by orally. They would take it orally with, I like glass thermometers with liquid metal. And I like them because they're very simple and they don't get decalibrated when you drop them, and they don't get sluggish when their battery goes down. And so they don't have mercury thermometers anymore, but there are liquid metal thermometers you can get pretty much at any drugstore or pharmacy that work really well. And the only actually brand that I know of out there is called Geratherm, Geratherm. And it's an alloy of three different metals in a liquid alloy form, and that works really well. I like the way they're calibrated. They are laser etched and water bath tested at the factory. But I have people take it by mouth 20 minutes away from before eating or after eating and away from eating. And then they could usually it takes only like 2 or 3 minutes to register a temperature with those particular thermometers.
Great. That's really helpful. And then, so how long should they collect the data for? And then are they taking an average of that over the course of the day?
Yes, exactly. They average those three temperatures together. And even if one's above 37, but the others cause the average to be lower than 37, I would still think that could be a problem. And then they could take it for 2 or 3 days. That would tell them a lot, just taking it for 2 or 3 days.
Okay, great. And assuming all other health parameters are staying the same, they're not flying, they're not distressed, or all of those pieces.
Right. And even so, it's usually a moot point because a lot of people are going to have a low temperature, and there's not going to be a little bit low. It's going to be quite low.
It's low. Like,
it's going to be like maybe 36.2 or 30 or even below 36. And so it's going to be significantly low, and it's going to be low pretty much no matter, you know, if they are traveling or if they are stressed or if they are doing this or that. But what I would suggest is if it is normal, let's say it's normal, it's a woman, it's normal, either I would check it with another thermometer, or if she, depending on where she's at her, on her menstrual cycle, she could wait. But really, it, like I said, it's usually not a, not, it's kind of a moot point, because usually people are low, a lot of people are low a lot. So.
Right. And a lot of people are just not, they're not healthy. Right. And what a, right. what a great tool to be able to start to give people data related to that.
Yeah. I mean, really, if you, if a person, I mean, just that temperature alone, like if somebody had nothing else to work with except temperature and herbs and nutrients, they could do a lot of good for 40% of the population, 30 at least. And so, which is really good compared to, you know, what, if you compare that to how much, people are benefiting from other, you know, mainstream approaches, you know, it's definitely a great place to start.
Yeah. So to that end then, and maybe temperature is part of your definition of this, but how would you define health?
I would say optimal functioning of the body, mind, and spirit, and emotionally, psychologically, and basically optimal function.
I really like that. Each month, I'm featuring a new Anthropology quiz to help you unlock and uncover some of the physical performance blocks that may be holding you back from your true potential. This month, we are talking about stress and adrenal fatigue. To learn more or to take the quiz, head on over to meganwalker.com/Anthropology quiz. So in looking at these key performance indicators or KPIs, I want to get a sense of how you live your life and some of your ideas around health and lifestyle and all of those different components. First question for you, do you have a consistent morning routine? And if so, what is it?
I do. I'm glad you asked me that. I do read scriptures and pray. And I also, one thing that I like to do is I have a morning routine, but one of the thing components of that is I call it flashcards. And, you know, sometimes during the day you go through, you're going along and you have an aha moment. You say to yourself, oh, that's something I need to remember and never forget. And of course, we always do forget them, except if we write them down and we refer to them on a regular basis. And so when I have a moment like that where I think, oh, that's something I really need to work on, that's something I really need to remember. And I need to remember that because I want to work on that. I want to develop that. So what I'll do is I'll record that in a flashcard. And I have mine in a digital format, but it could be paper or digital. But I'll remember these little sayings and ideas and quotes, and I'll read them one after another, and I'll rearrange them from day to day to put the most important ones higher, and the lesser important ones will slip down. But like right now, I have 152 cards, and I probably, you know, on most days I'll probably only read through the first 20 or 30, and I won't get to the rest of them. But they keep moving up that way. But I find that having something on the front of your mind is the best way to develop yourself over time.
I like that. That's a really unique part of the morning. I think that's a really great idea. Fiction or nonfiction?
Nonfiction.
And what are you reading right now?
Mindset is an interesting book. There's a book on psychology. The Untethered Soul is a really good book. I like another book called The Slight Edge by Jeff Olson. So there's quite a few books like that.
What's your hot beverage of choice, and how do you prepare it?
I like Celestial Seasonings, apple and cinnamon. And I heat the water and I pour it in my stainless steel vacuum tumbler. And then I'll heat that water and then I'll get the tea bag saturated and oozing out the tea, and then I'll add a little bit of extra filtered water to cool it off some, so that I don't have to wait to cool very much, and then I drink it.
You're an impatient tea drinker. I kind of like that.
Yeah.
What do you do for fun?
I like to ride bikes, for one thing. But if I really want to have fun, then I'll go to, I live in Florida, so I'll go to the beach and I'll participate in a sport I invented called skim skiing. And skim skiing involves, you might have heard of skimboarding, where people will take, they'll take a flat board and they'll, on the very skinny water that washes up on the shore.
Yeah.
And so the water comes up on the shore, and you might have quarter inch thick of water, and you can hydroplane on that. But the twist that I've used is I've added ski poles to the mix. And so I actually cross country skim ski down the beach, and I can go for a mile at a time doing that.
That is amazing. I have to see this in real life at some point. That's like a little bit of Canadian in there with this cross-country ski piece.
Last
question for you. Entrepreneurism. Are we born this way, or do we learn to become entrepreneurs?
I would tend to say both, because nature and nurture both play a role. Sometimes people have, I mean, we all have different proclivities or tendencies. And definitely our circumstances can influence that. Some people have opportunities and insight. Maybe they've seen and have had examples set for them by their parents or other people they've seen, and something struck them exciting about being able to make and do something of their own. And then, and other people, like I said, are either born that way or don't really have a mind-growing experience or mind-opening experience, and so they may never get to the point that they can believe in themselves enough to do something outside the box.
Right. Well, you are such a talented entrepreneur and clinician, and I really, really appreciate you taking the time to spend with us today. Where can people learn about more in terms of what you are up to, and how can they find you?
They can go to wilsonssyndrome.com. That's wilsonssyndrome.com, and read all about what we're doing there. There's a lot of resources available to them there. And if you have, we also have a physician website called restorativeformulations.com, and we help physicians learn how to implement our protocols as well.
This is amazing. We'll have all of this information for people to be able to access in the show notes. Dennis, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Megan. Sure appreciate it. Wonderful.
If you enjoyed our conversation and would like to hear more, head on over to Stitcher or iTunes and subscribe to the Entrepology Podcast. We would also really appreciate a quick review. When people have their health, they can change the world. Let us keep you healthy and you go change the world.